Volunteering at CJSF 90.1 FM is a great experience and is easy to get started. So I'll tell you a little bit about it in the hope that you reach out. As this station is run almost entirely by volunteers, you have a variety of ways to get active at CJSF. Every department can use a little bit of help. Arts and entertainment. Well, you can write and produce reviews, conduct interviews of local musicians, the music library, acquiring, organizing, reviewing, and compiling charts. Public affairs. Interviewing groups, attending events, recording lectures. Public relations, postering, graphic design, and programming. You can host your own show or work on a collective. Production, audio editing, and PSA building. And once you feel comfortable, you can even volunteer to help the volunteers. So volunteer with us at CJSF 90.1. Email us at vol4cjsf@sfu.ca.
You're listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional engineer, professional futurist, and sometimes occasional sessional instructor of future studies at Simon Fraser University. And this is a weekly show that looks at future trends and issues and important items that affect your daily life and will be affecting your life into the future. Welcome to the show. We're continuing our look at the book, What's Yours is Mine, Against the Sharing Economy by Tom Slee. Next section, open source software. In 1991, Finnish student Linus Talvads started work, quote-unquote, just for fun, on open-source operating system that would eventually become Linux, and it quickly became a phenomena. Linux was trumpeted as a triumph of the loosely coordinated amateur, that is, non-commercial efforts of hackers, that is, people programming for fun rather than as a job. And in 1998, Eric S. Raymond started his famous essay, The Cathedral and the Bazaar, in this way. Quote, Linux is subversive. Who would have thought, even 5 years ago, that a world-class operating system could coalesce as if by magic out of part-time hacking by several thousand developers scattered all over the planet, connected only by a tenuous strands of the internet? The success of Linux and other open source software projects spurred a wave of optimism about fundamentally new ways of creating complex products by relying on networks of peers. Yochai Benkler made an academic case for peer networks in his essay, quote, Coarse Penguin, Linux and the Nature of the Firm. And then again in his influential book, quote, The Wealth of Networks, unquote, holding up Linux as the archetype of a new form of production that would reshape economies. The traditional economy is driven in this view by markets and hierarchical firms and state organizations, but Benkler saw a third possibility, which he labeled common-based peer production. Commons-based because the result is not owned by anyone. Peer production because those who take part do so as peers. In The Coarse Penguin, Benkler describes the puzzle of why people contribute to Linux and other efforts. Quote, programmers do not generally participate in a project because someone who is their boss instructed them, though some do. They do not generally participate in a project because someone offers them a price, though some participants do focus on long-term appropriation through money-oriented activities, like consulting or service contracts. But the critical mass of participation in projects cannot be explained by the direct presence of a command, a price, or even a future monetary return, particularly in the all-important micro-level decisions regarding selection of projects to which participants contribute. In other words, programmers participate in free software projects without following the normal signals generated by market-based, firm-based, or hybrid models. The success of Linux seems to validate Benkler's hopes for this new form of production. Despite having to compete against commercial operating systems produced by some of the world's largest technology companies, such as Hewlett-Packard, IBM, Sun, and of course, Microsoft and Apple, the Linux Foundation can say, quote, today, Linux powers 98% of the world's supercomputers, most of the servers powering the internet, and the majority of financial trades worldwide and tens of millions of Android mobile phones and consumer devices. In short, Linux is everywhere, unquote. Linux continues to grow. And as it grows, it changes. Each year, the Linux Foundation issues a report on who writes the source code and who makes up the Linux kernel, which is the heart of the operating system. And the 2015 report is clear about the evolving nature of the huge project. The Linux kernel now has about an amazing 20 million lines of code, which is about 10 times larger than when Eric Raymond wrote his essay. The Linux kernel received nearly 100,000 separate contributions during the year 2014 from over 4,000 individual developers. But surprisingly, only 1 in 8 changes were from developers who are working with no financial contribution from any company. And, quote, well over 80% of all kernel development is demonstrably done by developers who are being paid for their work. The volume of contributions from unpaid developers has been in slow decline for many years. It was 14.6% in the 2012 version of this paper, 13.6% in 2013, and now it is 11.8%. More than half of our developers are paid to work on the kernel from their very first patch, unquote. Therefore, Linux is no longer a product of part-time hacking. Most of the programmers who work on the project earn a good living for doing so, just as those who work on proprietary software do. The companies that sponsor and contribute to Linux do not do so out of a generosity of their hearts. They do so for solid commercial reasons. Linux is no longer subversive. It has moved steadily away from being an outsider to taking its place as a comfortable part of the existing commercial world. In a way, if there is a revolution, Linux has won, but it's an Animal Farm victory. In winning, Linux has become like those it displaced, more professional, more structured, more carefully governed. Linux has not undermined powerful institutions and companies, although it has made some operating systems obsolete. Instead, these institutions have learned to live happily alongside with Linux and to even profit from it. The story of Linux is repeated in the wider world of open-source software. Originally described as a movement and still seen by some in that light, open source has succeeded in challenging powerful institutions only to put new powerful institutions in their place. There was a time when it made sense in the software industry to contrast open source initiatives such as Linux with closed source companies such as Microsoft being the preferred target. But now, the biggest software companies. as well as each new wave of startups mix open source and proprietary code in a pragmatic way. Keeping valuable work in-house and collaborating on open source projects for work that does not give the company a competitive advantage. Oracle and Microsoft are seen as closed-source companies, but Oracle owns the Java programming languages and the MySQL database, two of which are the most widely used open-source projects in the world. And Microsoft has made its NET programming languages open-source. Meanwhile, companies that proclaim their openness, such as Google, keep key parts of their intellectual properties under wraps. Like the Linux kernel, the open source world has become more professional over time. In 2014, a study showed that half of all contributions to open source projects happened during working hours. And in 2007, a PhD thesis showed that paid programmers and developers are more likely to maintain critical parts of the code base within open source projects. Even though the big internet companies all run on a combination of open source software and proprietary code, the culture of many Silicon Valley companies seems to require a belief in the virtues of open source computing and openness in general. Jonathan Rosenberg, Senior Vice President of Product Management, set out this belief in an email he sent to Google staff. It was received so well that Google reposted it on the company's official blog in December 2009. Rosenberg starts off by saying, quote, "At Google, we believe that open systems win. They lead to more innovation, value, and freedom of choice for consumers, and a vibrant, profitable, and competitive ecosystem for businesses." The document is passionate arguments in favor of open standards and open source software and against proprietary approaches to software, in favor of baking a bigger pie for everyone rather than trying to get the biggest slice for yourself. There's one exception to Rosenberg's argument, however. The eye rolling is unavoidable here. It turns out that Google's commitment to openness does not extend to the software that runs its core businesses of search and advertising. Quote, "Our goal is to keep the internet open, which promotes choice and competition and keeps users and developers from getting locked in. In many cases, most notably our search and ad products, opening up the code would not contribute to these goals and would actually hurt users. The search and advertising markets are already highly competitive with very low switching costs, so users and advertisers already have plenty of choice and are not locked in. Not to mention the fact that opening up these systems would allow people to game our own algorithms to manipulate search and ads quality rankings, reducing the quality for everyone." Unquote. Here, Rosenberg is understating the truth in two ways. First, Google's continued dominance of the search audiences argues against his contention of highly competitive markets. There are clearly major barriers to entry in the world of search. Second, in addition to the search and advertising products, Google has kept to itself the custom software it uses to run its massive data centers, including its home-built Google File System and Google Bigtable software, and has been closing off large parts of its Android smartphone operating system. The open systems that Rosenberg advocates serve as complements to closed black box algorithms, as law professor Frank Pasquale describes them in his recent book, which are the key to Google's business. 3 years on, Rosenberg was an advisor to Google management and found himself in a world that was outstripped by even its wildest expectations. Drawing on stories from books like Wikonomics on the Government of Canada's Open Government Declaration, on the non-profit Cannes Academy Video Lectures on patients like me in healthcare and Google's mapping tools, as well as Google's own success with Android smartphones and the Chrome browser, Rosenberg believes that openness needs to go even further. Quote, "We must aim beyond even the open internet. Institutions in general must continue to embrace this ethos. Here is the ambition of Silicon Valley to reshape the world in the internet's image. Open institutions, open governments, open access. It's the ambition that the sharing economy seeks to realize, to take the philosophy of openness and to reshape whole industries and their relationship to government, but to keep something for themselves." Rosenberg's ability to hold contradictory beliefs is symptomatic of Silicon Valley culture. He believes thoroughly in openness, congratulating himself and his industry for discovering a viewpoint that is, quote, counterintuitive to the traditionally trained MBA, who is taught to generate a sustainable competitive advantage by creating a closed system, making it popular, then milking it through the product life cycle. That he can do so while maintaining and passing that the software that actually makes money for Google must, regretfully and incidentally, remain closed is remarkable. But it is sadly typical of the Silicon Valley's outlook.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you're listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery. We're now going to take a short break and listen to a very important public service announcement.
Every year, countless people succumb to the temptation to purchase exotic animals like hedgehogs, lizards, monkeys, even tigers and bears to keep as pets. But life in captivity is often a death sentence for these animals, who may suffer from malnutrition, an improper environment, and the stress of confinement. For more information on this issue, visit the BCSPCA website at www.spca.bc.ca.
Welcome back. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional futurist.
Welcome back. We are looking at the book, What's Yours is Mine, Against the Sharing Economy by Tom Slee. There are many who still see open source software as a social movement rather than as part of the commercial world, who believe in the liberating possibilities of open source software, and who cast a baleful glare towards the giants of Silicon Valley. For example, in the fallout from the Snowden revelations about the NSA spying on the internet, computer security researcher Jacob Applebaum gave a keynote about the surveillance state at the 29C3 Chaos Communication Congress Hacker Conference in December of 2012. And included in this ringing economy for open source development, quote, "It is possible to make a living making free software for freedom instead of closed source proprietary malware for cops. Everyone that's worked on free software and open source software, these things we should try to focus on. When we build free and open source software, we are enabling people to be free in ways that they were not before. Literally, people who write free software are granting liberties to others." Unquote. Unfortunately, free and open source software is not an alternative to the surveillance technologies of the NSA. Openness does not align with liberty. Applebaum's opponents is the U.S. National Security Agency, and they have also embraced open source software in order to carry out the monitoring that Applebaum rightly decries. In the Snowden documents that Applebaum helped to release, the NSA's Boundless Informant Program proclaims that it leverages FOSS, F-O-S-S, standing for Free and Open Source Software Technology. For example, the Hadoop file system for storing massive amounts of data, MapReduce for running queries against that data, and the cloud-based database system are examples of this. The NSA is happy to use free software, but is not in the business of granting liberties. The NSA is not only a user of free software, it is active and enthusiastic member of the open source community, along with other parts of the U.S. military. To take one relevant example, the 2008, the NSA created Acumulo, a data storage and retrieval system for big data. Derek Harris at research company GigaOOM describes Acumulo as, quote, the technological linchpin to everything that the NSA is doing from a data analysis perspective, unquote. It is probably part of the Boundless Informant open source stack that stores and analyzes the Verizon FISA data. After developing Acumulo, the NSA submitted it to the Apache Foundation, the organization that provides support for the Apache community of open source software projects, which provide software products destined for the public good. In short, Acumulo, developed specifically for the purpose of spying on citizens and expanding the reach of the security state, is now nurtured and supported by the open source community. Next section. Open content. In the bursting of the dot-com bubble in 2000, this put the brakes on many commercial internet ambitions, but fortunately not for long. The second wave was Web 2.0, or the web as platform, as influential publisher Tim O'Reilly described it. In the Web 1.0 world of email and Usenet, content was distributed across a network of computers. In a Web 2.0 world, that content is hosted on a single farm of computers owned by a single organization and managed by that company's own software, what is often called a software platform. All Facebook posts live on Facebook servers, all tweets on Twitters, all YouTube videos on Googles. If there is an archetype for Web 2.0, in the way that Linux is an archetype for open source software, it is surely Wikipedia, the remarkable encyclopedia that anyone can edit. Wikipedia is so identified with web-based collaboration that its name has been incorporated into book titles. Wikinomics, how mass collaboration changes everything, and related initiatives such as the leaked documents, such as WikiLeaks. In Benkler's The Wealth of Networks, Wikipedia plays a predominant role as an exemplar of commons-based peer production. But Wikipedia turned out to be more the exception than the rule. While there are other not-for-profit, large-scale collaborative platforms, for example, OpenStreetMap, no other non-commercial site has reached anything resembling Wikipedia's influence. As Sun Gardner, then executive director of the Wikipedia Foundation, wrote in 2011, quote, Wikipedia represents the fulfillment of the original promise of the internet, It is a kind of poster child for online collaboration and the public interest. Because back when the internet started, we figured it would be full of stuff like Wikipedia. Turns out we were mostly wrong. If you take a look at the world's most popular websites, it's hard not to notice that Wikipedia is the only site in the top 25 whose primary purpose is to provide a non-commercial public service, unquote. By 2015, that top 25 could be extended to the top 50. In fact, the next non-commercial entry in the listings of highest traffic websites is an organization that an earlier age would have so disparaged by digital enthusiasts. The venerable British Broadcasting Corporation was in 70th spot. It turns out that being the owner of Web 2.0 platforms can be very profitable, but the idea that Web 2.0 performs where a new and democratizing force that could bring about a more open and equal culture was still compelling to many. It's an appeal that still resonates in the peer-to-peer claims of the sharing economy companies. Commercial Web 2.0 platforms such as Amazon, Netflix, iTunes may not be open in the sense that some of the content is controlled and licensed. But for the purposes of this book, we can consider Web 2.0 platforms to be inspired by ideas of open content. In his influential 2006 book, The Long Trail, Wired magazine editor Chris Anderson and the rise of Web 2.0 platforms like Amazon and Netflix in the same subversive and liberating versions invoked by open source software. His idea was that the bricks and mortar world of Walmart, bookseller retail chains, and record labels represent the world that Blockbuster built. And to have their business on the short head of high-volume products. In contrast, online stores are not constrained by the tyranny of geography. Amazon can present millions of books that are individually obscure, but which together make up the long tail of demand, while the biggest brick-and-mortar bookstores are limited to a few hundred thousand books. For Anderson, Amazon represents the return of variety and diversity after decades of homogeneous blockbusters. We are turning from a mass market back to a niche nation, defined not by geography but by interests. In the long tail, would there be no need for former gatekeepers who select or restrict the works that can find their public? Instead, Web 2.0 platforms will do it for us, being crowdsourced consumer reviews and recommender systems. By combining infinite shelf space with real-time information about buying trends and public opinions, unlimited selection is revealing truths about what consumers want and how they want to get it. We'll be looking at this in much more detail in future shows, so please stay tuned.
You have been listening to Future Talk on CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby, and Future Talk is a weekly show on important issues that affect you and your future. And this is Dr. Teneri, professional futurist, reminding you that if you're not willing to make the effort to invent your own future, then others will be only too happy to invent it for you. See you next week.
You're listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.